KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
If I want him out, he'll be out of there real fast, believe me.
President Trump's battles over the Federal Reserve, deportations, and tariffs. We will do our best to give you the key takeaways from just this one week at the White House.
It is Friday, April 18th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. A massive stream of exports and imports usually moves through the ports in L.A. and Long Beach.
But as the trade war grinds on, port workers are bracing themselves for tough times ahead.
I anticipate a drop of at least 10% in our cargo volume from July until the end of this year.
Also, when you hear the name Coachella, you probably think of a music festival.
That will take you into the history of the valley that it's named for.
They decided just to keep the name, even though Coachella itself does not mean anything.
And a new podcast features folktales from Sudan.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. A federal judge has once again blocked DOGE staffers who are operating inside the Social Security Administration from accessing sensitive personal information. NPR's Stephen Fowler has more.
U.S. District Judge Ellen Lipton Hollander wrote late Thursday that the legal issue isn't with the work that DOGE wants to do inside the Social Security Administration, but rather how they want to do the work. Last month, Hollander issued a temporary restraining order blocking DOGE staffers from sensitive Social Security databases because they couldn't explain why they needed unfettered access to personally identifiable information. In granting the preliminary injunction, the judge said that's a question the Trump administration still can't answer. Stephen Fowler, NPR News.
Kilmar Abrego Garcia, the man mistakenly sent to a maximum security prison in El Salvador, where he expressed concerns for his security, has been moved to a different facility. Senator Chris Van Hollen related the news to reporters upon returning from El Salvador and a visit with Abrego Garcia. He called on the Trump administration to return the man to the U.S. to receive due process. Five ACLU affiliates have filed a class action lawsuit to try to stop the federal government from revoking student visas without cause and required notice. Olivia Eberts of member station The Public's Radio reports.
The ACLU affiliates say over 100 student visas have already been revoked in New England. Stephen Brown is the executive director of the ACLU of Rhode Island. He says the lawsuit is meant to stop the federal government from upending these students' lives.
We have students here suddenly find themselves unable to continue with their education based on a completely arbitrary determination made by federal agencies.
The lawsuit comes as higher education officials say hundreds of international college students and professors across the country are losing their legal status and possibly facing deportation. For NPR News, I'm Olivia Eberts in Providence.
Officials at the Department of Veterans Affairs appear to be backing off an order requiring all mental health providers return to the office due to concerns that therapists might not have privacy due to overcrowding in facilities. NPR's Katia Riddle reports.
The memo appears to mandate that VA therapists have private spaces. It follows reporting from NPR suggesting clinicians at the VA would have to conduct telehealth therapy sessions with headsets in shared offices. Lynn Bufka is with the American Psychological Association. The organization has raised alarm about the policy.
They're seeking psychotherapy about things that are very personal, that they don't necessarily want to reveal to just anyone, even if it's another clinician who might be nearby and could overhear, right?
The VA has said repeatedly that veterans will be guaranteed private therapy sessions. Katie Riddle, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. U.S. officials will not move 21 prisoners off federal death row in Indiana for at least another month in response to a lawsuit. George Hale of member station WFIU has this report.
The ACLU is representing prisoners whose federal death sentences former President Biden commuted to life without parole last year. They say the Trump administration is getting even with a plan to ship them off to ADX Florence, the harshest prison in the federal system. Robert Dunham teaches death penalty law at Temple University.
I'm not aware of any circumstance in which the reduction of a prisoner's sentence has resulted in them being housed in more restrictive circumstances.
The relocation push follows President Trump's day one executive order instructing justice officials to ensure confinement conditions for clemency recipients align with the, quote, monstrosity of their crimes and the threats they pose. For NPR News, I'm George Hale in Bloomington, Indiana.
There's some good news about sea turtles in a global study from a Colorado environmental consulting group called Ecolibrium. Endangered sea turtles are showing signs of recovery in a majority of places where they're found worldwide. Turtle advocates have been aggressive in conservation efforts. The report examined 48 populations of sea turtles around the world. It found endangered sea turtles are recovering in a majority of places with threats from hunting, pollution, coastal development, and climate change declining overall. Atlantic Ocean sea turtles are showing the most encouraging results, with leatherback turtles still struggling. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. From tariffs to deportations, it can be hard to track all of the activity in the Trump White House. So we wanted to pause right now and go over some of the big stories this week and what we should take away from them. For that, let's bring in NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, and tracking it is my charge.
Okay, well, one big thing that happened this week, of course, was the debate over Kilmer Abrego Garcia. This is, of course, the Maryland man who was illegally deported to El Salvador. Will he ever be allowed back into the United States? What do we know?
Well, the Trump administration says that's not happening. There's no chance that he'll be allowed back, and that if he somehow made his way back to the United States, he'd be detained and deported. Now, the Trump administration did say that, I'm sorry, the Supreme Court did say that the Trump administration has to, quote, facilitate his return, but also said the courts need to give deference to a president's foreign policy. So the Trump administration has been using that to say that it's not responsibility to bring Abrego Garcia back and can't tell El Salvador what to do. When El Salvador's president, Nayib Bukele, was at the White House, he was asked whether he would send him back, and this is part of his response.
How can I return him to the United States? Like, I smuggle him into the United States, or what do I do? Of course, I'm not going to do it.
Saying, what would he do? Smuggle him in. Very facetious there. Clearly, Bukele is playing ball with the Trump administration. El Salvador is getting paid to house these deportees. And Trump even floated the idea of Bukele opening 5 more prisons to house homegrown criminals, in his words. In other words, U.S. citizens, something that would certainly be illegal. And yet the administration thinks it has the politics on its side when it comes to Abrego Garcia, but it's a very fine line.
Why does the White House think that this is a winning political issue for them?
Well, I mean, think about it. Every headline, every minute spent talking about this is one that people aren't talking about tariffs and the likelihood of high prices. Plus, look at the body language of Democrats. Some would rather steer clear of this completely and talk about the economy, while many others are, in fact, having this fight and want to make it about due process. Mm-hmm. That's been the message, for example, from Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, who met with Abrego Garcia in El Salvador yesterday after first being denied the chance to talk to him. Van Hollen this afternoon, by the way, said that Abrego Garcia has been moved to a less harsh facility. He and other Democrats point out that Abrego Garcia has legal status in the U.S., he has no criminal record, and he's married to an American citizen. The Trump administration, on the other hand, is trying to paint him as a gang member, domestic abuser, even a human trafficker, and they posted a police report contending he's in MS-13, but a judge this week called that evidence pretty flimsy of him being in a gang. But this is exactly the conversation and ensuing debate that the Trump administration wants people to have, because so much of politics is about how things are framed, which narratives dominate. And arguing about due process can be esoteric and nuanced, harder to make resonate viscerally with people than simply saying he's a criminal and criminals should be out.
Totally. Okay, let's move from immigration to the economy now. We saw this whole tense back and forth between Trump and the chair of the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, which all seems really unusual, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Powell gave a speech before the Chicago Economic Club this week and said that tariffs were bigger than expected that Trump put in place and are likely to lead to higher prices. And they're putting the Fed in a tough position. You know, the Fed essentially looks to keep two things under control. If you think about it, inflation, unemployment are the two things. And Powell said that the Fed may face a tension in coming weeks and months on which one of those to address. For now, he's going to do nothing. Remember, part of the Fed's job is to project certainty, to calm markets, and to keep things moving. Mm-hmm. Powell's comments, though, really got under Trump's skin. He said on social media that Powell's termination cannot come fast enough. And when asked about Powell in the Oval Office, here's what Trump had to say.
I don't think he's doing the job. He's too late, always too late, a little slow, and I'm not happy with him. I let him know it, and if I want him out, he'll be out of there real fast, believe me.
Yeah, so clearly Trump's irritated with him, wants to see him go, despite the fact that Trump is the one who appointed him in the first place in his first term. You know, he wants to be able to control every aspect of his administration, certainly be able to make tweaks to bring rates down or bring rates up to help him politically. You know, Powell, for his part, said he's not only not going to resign, but that he has to be fired for cause.
But explain to people, can the president just fire the chair of the Fed?
Yeah, it's unclear what he's done in the past with people who've had these independent terms that overlap presidencies is try to put pressure on them to get them out. But whether Trump can fire heads of quasi-independent agencies, likely to end up at the Supreme Court, there is a 90-year precedent that essentially says someone cannot be fired from these agencies except for malfeasance, corruption, bribery, things like that. But conservatives have long disliked this ruling because it curtails the powers of a president. And as we know, this conservative majority court has overturned long-held precedent on plenty of other things, too.
That is NPR's Domenico Montanaro. Thank you so much, Domenico.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Amtrak will be taking over renovations at New York's Penn Station. That's according to a letter sent by the Federal Railroad Administration late Thursday. The station has already undergone a partial renovation, but a more wide-scale plan had been discussed for years without any movement. From member station WNYC in New York, Stephen Nesson reports.
Penn Station is the busiest train hub in the Western Hemisphere. More than 600,000 people a day pass through it via three different railroads. There's the MTA, which runs the subway there, and the Long Island Railroad. It recently completed a renovation of its section of the train hall with a taller ceiling with blonde wood paneling, new entrances, and large blue panel lights. The New Jersey Transit and Amtrak sides of the terminal, in contrast, are a rat maze of low-slung ceilings and confusing corridors with dingy lighting. Until yesterday, the three agencies had been cooperating on plans to both upgrade the other sections of the train hall and expand the number of tracks underground to meet the increased demand from riders. But that appears to be over. In a letter, the Federal Railroad Administration says Amtrak will now be the lead agency when it comes to redeveloping Penn Station. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy slammed the MTA, writing that its history of inefficiency, waste, and mismanagement meant it had to step aside. Tom Wright is with the transit think tank, the Regional Plan Association, and says the Penn Station overhaul has been stalled for years.
You know, the MTA had real success with the renovation of the Long Island Railroad concourse, but things haven't been moving forward lately as the railroads have had kind of competing demands. And from my perspective, Penn Station is owned by Amtrak, the federal government, and it makes sense for them to be leading the renovation plans.
In a statement, Governor Kathy Hochul of New York says she's had several meetings with President Trump asking for more federal funds for Penn Station. She thanked the feds for covering the cost of what could be a $7 billion overhaul. She called it a major victory for New Yorkers. Commuter Allison Chapin from Hoboken, New Jersey, was passing through Penn Station on Friday and says she doubts one agency can complete the work alone.
My first thought was it would be really great if the MTA and Amtrak and the state and federal government could just work together to do the right thing for all of the riders and the passengers.
Two of the biggest challenges that have bedeviled Penn Station developers, what to do with the sports and concert arena on top of the train hall, Madison Square Garden, and how to expand tracks below ground without demolishing a city block above ground. For NPR News, I'm Stephen Nesson in New York.
It's the second weekend of Coachella, the star-studded music festival that draws tens of thousands of fans every year to Southern California, specifically to the Coachella Valley. How did this stretch of desert become synonymous with one of the hottest events in music? Well, NPR's Rachel Treisman went to find out.
When you hear Coachella, you probably think of the festival. It's hosted some of the biggest names in music over the last two decades, from Radiohead to Daft Punk to Beyonce. Let's go get them. But the festival isn't actually in Coachella. It's in the city of Indio. They're both part of the Coachella Valley, along with cities like Palm Springs and Indian Wells. The whole area was a hub for culture and celebrity long before the festival arrived in 1999.
This valley was a very famous venue for golf and tennis and other forms of entertainment for decades before Coachella Music Festival entered the public consciousness.
That's Jeff Kreider, a freelance writer who lives in and wrote a book on the Coachella Valley. The valley was named after the city, and the city wasn't always called Coachella.
The original name of the town was Woodspur, and it was literally just like an off-ramp from the Southern Pacific Railroad.
At the turn of the 20th century, its founders wanted to rename it Conchilla, which means little shell in Spanish. But the document that came back from the printer misspelled it as Coachella.
They decided just to keep the name, even though Coachella itself does not mean anything.
The valley's warm climate and fertile soil made it a hub for agricultural production. Meanwhile, celebrities flocked to the hotels and winter homes of Palm Springs.
We not only have, you know, the movie stars and the former presidents and whatnot coming out here, but we started having more and more entertainment out here.
One of the venues the valley built to host those events was the Empire Polo Club in Indio. Legend has it that Coachella co-founder Paul Tillett, a concert promoter, fell in love with the venue after helping Pearl Jam book a gig there in the early 1990s. The festival made its debut a few years later and has been held at the Polo Club ever since. After a bumpy start, Coachella has become one of the most popular and profitable music festivals in the world. That's welcome news for the region, which still depends on tourism and agriculture.
The majority of the people who live and work out here year-round are not rich and famous. Many, many, many of them are struggling to make it.
Kreider says that discrepancy may not be top of mind for people who come only for the festival, where ticket prices start around $600. Rachel Treisman, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The busiest port in North America is actually two ports. Nearly a third of everything the U.S. imports or exports in containers over water comes through the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. Officials say there was a big bump in business early this year as companies rushed to ship goods here before the new tariffs. But now that tariffs on China are in place, with potentially more to come, some workers are already suffering, as Kelly McEvers reports.
So I'm walking along this road. It's like 2 miles from the port, but it is like the artery for all of the trucks going in and out of the port. They come in, they pick up the load, they come out, they drop it off to where it needs to be. And then all along the side of the road, the trucks are parked, either taking a break, getting some lunch, or just waiting until they get a call to go back and pick up another load.
I climb up into the cabin of one big rig and talk to the driver, Joel Duenas.
I'm curious about business. How are things going?
Horrible, he says, using an adjective I can't repeat. Up until recently, Duenas says he made about $1,000 a day. Now he makes $300. That's because even though there has been a big jump in cargo ahead of the tariffs, there's a lot of uncertainty about what will happen next. The Harbor Trucking Association, which represents West Coast trucking companies, says companies further up the shipping chain are raising costs on them because of that uncertainty. And in turn, trucking companies are lowering the rate they pay drivers. Duenas says he's hoping for a Hail Mary, but doesn't think there'll be one.
What are you thinking about the future?
I don't know. Go back to school.
Go back to school for what?
Something else. The trucking ain't it.
Duenas says he can still make rent, but barely. To do that, he has to work 15 to 18 hours a day. Gene Soroka is executive director of the Port of Los Angeles. He recently told reporters he's aware that companies up and down the chain, from retailers to transporters, are skittish. He says now that the tariffs on China have kicked in, things could get even worse.
I anticipate a drop of at least 10% in our cargo volume from July until the end of this year. But that drop-off could begin as early as next month in May.
Hauling cargo is a big employer across the country. Here in Southern California, officials say these ports account for 1 in 8 jobs. Soroka says he doesn't think there'll be mass layoffs at the port, but he thinks people like truckers, longshore members, and custom house brokers will all get less work and fewer hours.
The bottom line is this. The ripple effect of these tariffs will be felt by all of us, and there's no way around that.
For NPR News, I'm Kelly McEvers in Los Angeles.
There's a new podcast that, at least on the surface, is about telling children's folk tales.
These were stories that were told to me by my mom, my uncle, Albarir, my aunties. They were handed down stories about all kinds of characters. Mean stepsisters, magical treasures, brave girls escaping scary ogres.
But it is important that these stories are from Sudan, which on this show we've been hearing a lot about as a place devastated by a civil war that is now entering a third year and as a home to the world's largest and most devastating humanitarian crisis, according to the UN. So the podcast, Folk Tales from Sudan, tells us about a culture that is currently under attack. Host Hana Baba joins us today from member station KALW in San Francisco, where she also hosts a daily news show. Welcome, Hana.
Thank you for having me, Elsa. Oh,
thank you for being with us. So your family is Sudanese. You came to the U.S. when you were very little, and it sounds like you grew up listening to many of these stories yourself, yeah?
Yeah, my mother would tell me these stories in our very American Houston, Texas home in the 1980s. And then we'd go on visits to Sudan, and my uncle, our main storyteller, Al-Baghir, would tell us these stories as well. And it was It was this incredible kind of performance of folk tales.
Oh, he would like act out the characters?
He would totally act out all the characters, the ghoul and the princess.
Really? Oh.
And so it was really theatrical.
And there's a wide range of these tales. Like you lay out in the trailer for the podcast that Sudanese folklore covers such a broad variety. So far, there's been a story about a father and his three sons, one of whom compares his love for his father to his love of salt, which does not sit well with the dad.
Really? Salt? The father was angry and said, "What? What kind of answer is that? What kind of a love is that? Your brothers said such valuable things like gold and silver, and you say you love me like you love cheap salt?"
There's also another story about a boy and a talking bird, one about an adventurous goat. Is there anything thematic that you think ties some of these stories together?
I think the overall theme is the idea of this is from the people, right? This is It's ancient and just coming from a place that is organic storytelling from people who were illiterate, right? Like, this is from the earth. This is from heritage. And that's the beauty of it.
Absolutely. Especially, you know, as we mentioned, this podcast, it's coming out during a terrible war in Sudan. And many people who hear about Sudan today only hear about it in the context of these horrible news stories. What do you think these folk tales can tell us about the country?
I am a big believer in cultural diplomacy, in that when you hear the music, read the literature, taste the food of a people, You come closer to them. You're connected to them. You care about them. I want people to be able to, when they hear the word Sudan, to think maybe of a story. Maybe they think about a beautiful princess that comes down the hill and her shimmering gown. And That's just a different image that I would love for people to have, in addition to the struggle and the strife and the conflict, which is a part of our story, but it's not the full story.
It is not the only story.
Right.
Are your family members still in Sudan currently?
I do have family members in Sudan. In fact,
how are they?
They say they're well, because they don't want to worry anybody. But we see the news. We hear the WhatsApp messages. We know it is a very difficult time. The very uncle that told me the stories had to flee the country and go to safety. That house that I heard the stories in is empty. And so that is telling as well, the idea that our elders are aging and they're traumatized now. And that really puts an urgency for me to tell these stories at this time.
Yes. Hanna Baba is the host of the podcast Folk Tales from Sudan from KALW. Thank you so much for joining us, Hanna.
Thank you, Elsa. It was a pleasure.
This is NPR News.
NPR's tiny desk is exactly what it sounds like. Just a regular desk in an office building where a lot of us actually work. But it's also so much more.
More than 1,200 artists have visited the tiny desk since 2008.
That's a lot of shows.
Now you can catch those performances on the brand new Tiny Desk Radio. We talked to the show's co-host, Anna Maria Serre, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
What?
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Coming up, why more and more straight women are saying no to marriage.
He expected that if they got married and have kids, she would be the one to take a step back from her career, and she just wasn't willing to abide that.
That story after this summary of all the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The Trump administration is yet to comply with a federal court order to facilitate the return of a deported Maryland man back to the U.S. President Trump claiming again today that Kilmar Brego Garcia is an MS-13 gang member, which his family and advocates deny. Senator Chris Van Hollen, a Democrat representing Maryland, says he got a chance to meet with Brego Garcia in El Salvador and says he's been moved from that notorious mega prison.
He was moved to another detention center in Santa Ana, where the conditions are better. But he said despite the better conditions, he still has no access to any news from the outside world and no ability to communicate with anybody in the outside world.
A federal appeals court yesterday denied the Trump administration's request to lift a judge's order that the government helped bring Abrego Garcia back to the U.S. The administration has redirected government websites about COVID-19 to a White House page that's dedicated to a controversial theory about the virus leaking from a Chinese lab. NPR's Rob Stein with more.
The original federal websites had provided the public with basic information about COVID-19, such as vaccines, treatment, and testing. But those sites are gone and now direct visitors to the White House website and a page titled Lab Leak, The True Origins of COVID-19. That theory argues the virus escaped from a Chinese government lab in Wuhan, China, and then spread around the world. Most scientists believe that the virus most likely originated naturally in a wild animal and then spread to people in a market located in Wuhan. Rob Stein, NPR News.
This is NPR. In the Middle East, Hamas says Israel's latest ceasefire proposal does not meet its criteria for permanently ending the war. Meanwhile, families of Israeli hostages are demanding their release, as NPR's Aya Betraoui reports.
Israel's ceasefire offer would have released half the living hostages still held in Gaza and eased a weeks-long blockade on the territory where aid groups say food is running out. Crucially, it would have also halted for 6 weeks Israeli airstrikes and ground offensives that Gaza's health ministry says have killed around 1,700 people since the last ceasefire ended a month ago. Israel's proposal, however, had a new explicit demand that Gaza be disarmed, with Hamas giving up its weapons. The group's chief negotiator, Khalil al-Hayya, said in public remarks, Hamas is prepared to release all Israeli hostages for a complete end to the war and Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. But he said resistance is a, quote, natural right of all people under occupation, and said weapons are linked to that. Aya Betraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
A mountain cable car crash in Italy has killed 4 people south of Naples. Authorities there say the cable car plunged into a ravine on a popular attraction known for its views of Mount Vesuvius. Reports suggest a traction cable snapped and may have led to the accident. 3 foreign tourists and the driver of the cable car died. Officials say the ride had recently reopened for the season. No trading on Wall Street in observance of Good Friday. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services, from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Every day, it seems new conflicts arise between President Trump and the courts, prompting another round of the question, are we in a constitutional crisis? So today, we're going to put that question to our own Nina Totenberg, who has been covering the Supreme Court for more decades than she likes to admit publicly. Hi, Nina.
Hi there.
Come on, how many decades?
Mm-mm.
Okay, let's get serious, because it's a serious question. Is the country in a constitutional crisis?
Well, to answer that question, let me quote a Supreme Court justice who famously said, in talking about pornography, you know it when you see it. The same is true with determining whether we're in the midst of a constitutional crisis. The one time I thought we were in the midst of a constitutional crisis was when the Supreme Court ordered President Nixon to turn over the Watergate tapes, and he toyed with the idea of refusing to comply until his counsel, James Sinclair, told him that he really could not stiff the Supreme Court of the United States, or it would precipitate a constitutional crisis, and he would lose most of his Republican support in Congress, which he ultimately did anyway. But I'm not sure Donald Trump can do anything to lose his Republican support in Congress. Still, in a clash with the Supreme Court, he could lose a lot.
Such an interesting reminder of tiptoeing up to the brink of a constitutional crisis there in the 1970s. What about today? Your answer to my question of are we in the middle of a constitutional crisis is kind of?
Think of this as a pot on the stove. A few days ago, I would have said the flame controlling the temperature is on medium. But today, I'd say it's inching up there, closer to a full-on clash between the Supreme Court and the president.
And why? What's changed in the last few days?
Just last week, the Supreme Court told the Trump administration it had to, quote, facilitate the return of a Maryland man named Kilmer Abrego Garcia to the U.S., where he was under a protective order barring his deportation. Since then, of course, President Trump has insisted he has no obligation to return Abrego Garcia, who was grabbed by ICE officials and deported to El Salvador and a prison there. And we have had the spectacle of the president of El Salvador meeting with Trump at the White House and the two of them gleefully pronouncing that they had no obligation to do what the Supreme Court had just told Trump to do. And Trump continues to flirt with the idea of deporting American citizens as well. Meanwhile, the federal district judge in charge of the case, Paula Zinis, has basically been stiffed by the administration in her efforts to get information about what it's doing to get Abrego Garcia back. So now she, for the first time, has raised the prospect of holding contempt proceedings against the government, and the administration went to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, asking it to block her action, which the appeals court refused to do.
Okay, so that brings us up to now. And this, just stay with the Fourth Circuit for a minute, because this was quite a remarkable opinion that they issued backing up Judge Zinis's attempt to get information. Tell us about it.
Writing for a unanimous three-judge panel, Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson, a very conservative judge appointed by President Reagan, said that the Supreme Court's order to facilitate Abrego Garcia's return does not permit an admittedly mistaken deportation to continue without affording Abrego Garcia the due process of law in the United States to which he is entitled. And, he went on, if the executive claims the right to deport without due process and in disregard for court orders, what assurances will there be tomorrow that it will not deport American citizens and then disclaim responsibility to bring them home? And what assurances shall there be that the executive will not train its broad discretionary authority upon its political enemies? He concluded by saying, now the branches come too close to grinding irrevocably against one another in a conflict that promises to diminish both. If the administration continues on this road, he said, the tragic end will be that law, in time, will sign its epitaph.
And NPR's Nina Totenberg, thank you.
My pleasure.
More than 900,000 would-be asylum seekers who entered the U.S. legally under the Biden administration are now being given just 1 week to leave the country under President Trump. You see, they used a smartphone app that regulated the number of asylum seekers and granted them humanitarian parole that allowed them to legally live and work here temporarily. Now, the order to leave, while many of them have asylum cases pending in court, have them confused about what to do. KJZZ's Elisa Resnick reports from Tucson.
Wendy Lopez fled gang violence in El Salvador, and she and her family spent years trying to get asylum in the U.S. In 2023, they legally entered the U.S. from Mexico using the CBP One phone app. That granted them humanitarian parole, which generally allows recipients to stay and legally work in the U.S. for 2 years. Lopez's family was then granted asylum by a judge last fall. She says she felt a surge of relief. I know it's almost impossible for most people to win an asylum case here, she says. But less than a month later, the Biden administration's Department of Homeland Security appealed her case.
Pero imagínese, sentir esa alegría y en pocos días tener como...
Imagine feeling all that joy, she says, and a few days later, back to uncertainty. They've been awaiting new appeal proceedings since then. Then a week ago, they received an email from DHS saying they had 7 days to leave the U.S.
Sentí una cosa tan fea en mi pecho, como una preocupación horrible.
I felt something so ugly in my chest, she says, a horrible worry. Dora Rodriguez, an immigrant rights activist in Tucson, says now people receiving the DHS notices are confused. Are they supposed to wait to hear about their case or follow the new orders to leave?
You know, we have families who said, well, I'm just going to hide because I cannot go back to my home country. I will be killed, so I prefer to hide.
She says others are so terrified of getting separated from their children that they're choosing to leave on their own. A Venezuelan family she knows had just packed up and went to Mexico.
They don't know how Mexico is going to treat them, or they're going to go back to be in the hands of the organized crime.
Monica Cordero with the Florence Immigrant and Refugee Rights Project says people with active immigration cases have the right to stay and fight those cases. Leaving, even voluntarily, could risk formal deportation and potential bars from entering the U.S. again.
According to the law, if they don't show up for an existing court hearing, the judge has the authority to issue a removal order, a deportation order.
Migrants and advocates say the notices have been sent out broadly. Even some U.S.-born attorneys have reported receiving them. DHS officials did not respond to an interview request for this story, and in a statement didn't say what happens to those already in active asylum cases. It said the agency is canceling parole statuses using discretionary authority. Esther Sung with the Justice Action Center says that's unprecedented on this scale.
Never before in the history of the parole authority granted to the executive has the president or the executive attempted to engage in mass revocations of individual grants of parole.
Wendy Lopez, the Salvadoran mother, says her family is waiting to hear from their lawyer, but says sometimes this type of situation breaks a person.
Pero yo digo que no nos tenemos que dar por vencidos y luchar por lo que queremos, más que todo por el bienestar de nuestros hijos.
But I say we must not give up. We must fight for what we want, she says. Above all, for the well-being of our children. For NPR News, I'm Elisa Resnick in Tucson.
You are listening to All Things Considered. A big focus of the Trump administration is to shore up U.S. dominance in cutting-edge technology, things like semiconductor chips and artificial intelligence. But President Trump has also been slashing employees at the very agency that works on these issues. NPR's Emily Fang has more.
The U.S.'s tech rivalry with China focuses a lot on semiconductors. Here's President Trump speaking in March, welcoming investment from a top Taiwanese chipmaker.
Semiconductors are the backbone of the 21st century economy, and really, without the semiconductors, there is no economy.
A key federal agency that oversees grants and research on AI and semiconductors is something called the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST. But about 500 employees there so far, nearly a sixth of the agency's headcount, have been terminated. Part of a dramatic cost-cutting exercise led by Trump and his ally Elon Musk. Matt Shears heads a tech industry group, and he warns hobbling NIST like this could cede AI competitiveness to China.
At the end of the day, we want the global AI benchmark to be written in English, not Mandarin.
What he means is he worries competing countries like China will take the lead to set standards for evaluating and regulating AI. Trump also paused a Biden-era initiative on AI standards, saying it was, quote, a barrier to innovation. But all this has worried industry groups like Shears.
We run the risk that that open, flexible, inclusive approach is replaced by foreign actors that have an economic interest that isn't consistent with our own.
Many of those cut at NIST this year were working on semiconductor policies. NIST and the Trump White House didn't respond to NPR's request for comment. But Haley Stevens, a Democratic congresswoman from Michigan, says those job cuts are giving up huge long-term gains for not much in short-term savings.
We're talking, you know, pennies on the dollar, you know, in terms of what's the investment, you know, outcome there for us.
Plus, the hiring freeze across the federal government has hamstrung research at NIST because they can't fill open positions. Zuoyue Wang, a professor at California State Polytechnic University who studies the history of science and politics, points out there have been cycles of big cuts to science and tech in the 1950s and then the 1970s, but they were reversed when the U.S. experienced its Sputnik moment.
In 1957, that was so dramatic that the public paid attention to the perceived setback of American prestige in the world.
The Soviets had beat the U.S. in sending the first satellite, the Sputnik, into orbit around Earth. The U.S. reversed cuts to science and tech funding. But Wang says this time around,
absent of anything as dramatic as Sputnik, it's not clear that, you know, the public will react very strongly to federal cutbacks in funding for science.
At a House hearing on Capitol Hill this month, however, AI computer scientist Julia Stoyanovich testified,
we are in a Sputnik moment.
Given the emergence of the Chinese AI chatbot DeepSeek this year.
The rapid rise, technical openness, and competitive performance of DeepSeek have challenged the long-standing assumption that the U.S. would retain its global leadership in AI by default.
Wang, the historian, says public opinion is often reactive, and historically, support for science funding does not bounce back until the U.S. feels like it's already fallen behind. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ailsa Chang. So do you want to get married? I mean, I'm not proposing to you, to be clear, because I don't think I ever want to be married again. And I'm not alone here. Recent reports and surveys are showing that for a growing number of women, women who are not married prefer to stay single over getting married. NPR's Brittany Luce is the host of the It's Been a Minute podcast and has been digging into some of this. She joins us now. Hey, Brittany.
Hi, Ailsa.
Hi. Okay, so in a recent episode on your podcast, you noted this one survey from the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative-leaning think tank, and it found that among college educated women, half of them said that they were not married because they couldn't find someone to meet their expectations. And then on the flip side, only a quarter of men said the exact same thing. And I have I have so many theories about why this is, but let me ask you, why might more women, straight women, I'm assuming, be okay with staying single? And by single, we mean simply not married, right? Like some of these single women might be dating people or are interested in relationships, yeah?
I mean, yeah, I got the understanding that some of these women are interested in having a relationship, but marriage doesn't seem to be the end all be all at this point in their lives.
I
ended up talking to two really smart writers about all of this. And one of them, author Minda Honey, summed it up all with this question. Am I willing to get married at the expense of my happiness?
That's no
a question. Okay. That's a deep question. Or in other words, maybe I want to get married, but do I need it to be happy?
Right.
There's this schism right now happening all across culture, but also between men and women. There's different balances in financial and educational inequality between them. And frankly, a lot of women feel like there's an emotional inequality there as well. And as a result, the share of single women ages 18 to 40 is up to 51.4%.
So fascinating. Okay, there is so much to get into here, but I want to start with this idea of a cultural schism that you talk about between men and women. Tell me about what you mean by that exactly.
Yeah, totally. We're in this interesting moment where women have been thriving economically. And today, there's almost no difference in average wealth for single men and single women. But at the same time, we're seeing women more and more likely to politically align with the left, while men are more and more likely to align with the right, which might include the idea that they would embrace more traditional normative gender roles. I talked with Rachel Wolf about this. She's an economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and she shared this story with me that I think really captures how all of this is playing out in the dating pool.
You have people like Alicia, who I spoke to, who was making 50% more than her partner, but he expected that if they got married and have kids, she would be the one to take a step back from her career, and she just wasn't willing to abide that.
That is crazy to me.
It would seem that way to quite a few people. But that embrace of old school gender roles by men is something that I've been hearing anecdotally from friends and loved ones for a while now.
Okay, just speaking for myself, like I am still pro relationship. I just think I don't need a legal certificate for that relationship. And I don't want to have my finances entwined with someone else's. So for me, I'm just wondering, like, are we finding that men are returning to those old school gender roles more, the ones that you mentioned, or are women just more likely to push back against traditional gender roles? What do you think?
That is such a good question, and exactly what the other writer I talked to, Minda Honey, was getting at. Here's what she had to say.
You know, my mother was 10 years old when the law was passed that women could access credit so that we could get credit cards in our own name, mortgages in our own names. Before that, your father, your brother, your husband had to sign on your behalf. So we're part of this first generation of women who were born with the right to credit. So you pair that with a college degree, and suddenly we have the financial and social capital to not tolerate things that we don't want to be a feature in our lives.
So basically, the dating pool increasingly ends up becoming this case study, really, in how power is balancing between the genders, which honestly, I have to say, I enjoyed my dating days, but it makes me glad I am married to someone that I really like now, because dating sounds so intense right now.
It is. It has been so overwhelming. And Brittany, there's so much I would love to tell you about on that front, but maybe not on NPR. Fair. So let's cut the mice and get some wine.
I love that.
Always so fun to talk to you. I cannot wait to have you back on the show.
Oh, thanks, Elsa. It's always a pleasure to be here.
That was Brittany Luce. She is the host of NPR's It's Been a Minute, a show all about exploring what's going on in our culture.
And now to Arizona, where the family of 2-year-old Bowden Allen reported him missing earlier this week.
The Yavapai County Sheriff's Office said that he wandered away from home and feared the worst after seeing mountain lions during their search.
So terrifying. Such a terrifying experience for any parent.
Totally. But luckily, a hero was waiting in the wings.
Enter Scotty Dunton and his wife, Dawn. They run Dunton Ranch near Kingman, Arizona. That's several miles from the Allens' home.
The ranch is guarded by Buford, their dog, a 165-pound Anatolian Pyrenees.
He's like the guardian dog. He just patrols and stuff around there at night and keeps coyotes and things away and protects all the chickens and baby calves and everything around. He just, their breed, that's what they do. They're just guardian dogs.
Okay, so back to this week. Tuesday morning, like most ranchers, Scotty Dutton gets up, prepares for the day's chores. But before he can dig into his work, he sees something, let's say, unexpected.
I had to run to town, so I jumped in my truck to leave, and I was going down the driveway, and I see Buford walking down the fence line with this little blonde-haired kid in tow.
Dunton's wife told him about the missing child that morning, and he immediately knew that was him.
He took the toddler inside, fed him some string cheese and a banana, and called the sheriff.
I asked him, I said, did you walk all night? And he said, no. I said, what did you do? And he kept saying tree. I said, did you go lay under a tree? And he said, yep. And I said, did my dog find you? And he said, yep.
Buford, or Big Buford, as I've decided to nickname him, had apparently seen the lost boy wandering near the grounds and led him back to safety.
He's a big dog, but he's got the most laid-back personality even when he was a puppy. He's just real, real calm, laid-back, doesn't really get excited over much.
Dunton followed the toddler's tracks more than a mile, and Buford's paw prints were right next to the kids all along the way.
His dad just frantically ran over, you know, and grabbed him, and he was so glad to see him, and rightly so. I can't even imagine the ordeal they went through, so.
A massive sigh of relief for everyone.
There was 1,000 ways that could have gone really, really bad, and it turned out for the best.
The best for little Bowden and, of course, his family, and, as it turns out, for Big Buford, too.
Oh, yeah. Everybody was like, you need to cook him a steak for dinner. So my wife did. He had a pound and a half ribeye for dinner. So, yeah, he got a treat.
Not all heroes wear capes, but apparently some wear collars.
And some fluffy fur.
Happy Friday from All Things Considered at NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. And from Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side.
La-dee-doo-dee-doo, what can it be? La-dee-doo-dee-doo, it bothers me. La-dee-doo-dee-doo, gets in your hair.